The Select Committee on Hurricane Resiliency and Recovery will now come to order. Margarita, please call the roll.
Chair Grant.
Here.
Vice Chair Botana.
Here.
Ranking Member Chambliss.
Here.
Representatives Busata Cabrera. Cassell.
Here.
Escamani.
Here.
Esposito.
Here.
Franklin.
Present.
Jalombardo. Mooney.
Here.
Plasencia.
Here.
Roach.
Present.
Schoaf. Stevenson is excused. Tant.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, good afternoon and welcome back. Today, we're going to have a full agenda with two panel discussions. The first will be a panel of state attorneys who will discuss post-hurricane contractor fraud. Unfortunately, there are some individuals, unscrupulous, who seek to take advantage of some victims who get hurt by a hurricane and then get victimized again by unscrupulous contractors. The second panel will be comprised of members of our agriculture industry. As we're all aware, impacts to ag are in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and that number will continue to grow. I expect that the panelists will offer a unique perspective of post-hurricane Idalia agriculture impacts. And with that, let's get started. I've discussed the issue of post-hurricane contractor fraud with my state attorney, Amira Fox. I've been working with her for a number of years on this issue, and she has helped us organize this panel that we have here today. So members, please hold your questions until each of the panelists have finished their remarks. First we have is up is James Miller. He's the Assistant State Attorney for Economic Crime and the Economic Crime Unit Chief of the 20th Judicial Circuit. Sir, you can speak from there or you can, whichever. Welcome, Mr. Miller. You are recognized.
Do I have to hold it in? Can you hear me? Thank you. It's a great way to start. Members of the committee, my name is James Miller, but most people call me JD. I am an assistant state attorney for the 20th Judicial Circuit. I have the privilege of honor of working for State Attorney Amira Fox as the Economic Crime Unit Chief. Ms. Fox asked me to speak to you here today because she knows this is a topic my unit knows far too well. Many of you on this committee are from areas that represent the 20th Circuit, so you know the devastation and the destruction that Ian had on our area. Despite what sometimes looks like life back to normal, it is still a deep climb to rebuild. For example, this summer I tried a racketeering case with a 30-plus year prosecutor, and that prosecutor was living in a trailer in his driveway. My secretary is still living in FEMA housing as her condo gets rebuilt. One of the things the hurricane brought was an influx of cases. So my unit, beyond the normal embezzlements, insurance fraud, Ponzi schemes, and financial crimes against the elderly that we normally handle, has seen our caseloads triple. We sometimes say that we are now the construction unit. In my office is a table where I often sit down with victims and discuss their cases. And I am sick and tired of the victims' tears from dealing with contractors. In Southwest Florida, you have people from all walks of life. You have the people who move there from the north for their retirement in the hopes of their dream life. You have people who spend their life savings building a home. You have the people who live there who make up a community, such as first responders, teachers, doctors, even the people who work at Publix. Maybe those people are rebuilding from the storm, or maybe they are just using their savings to try to make an improvement. Too often, those citizens sit in my office on those occasions where we can't even make a case against their contractors, and they spread their tears. Inevitably, I have to have a conversation with them. And I have to explain to them that the defendant is gonna go to jail or prison. And they ask me about their money, and I have to tell them it's gone. The life savings, the 401k they cashed in, the insurance money, they have to figure out a way to live their life and get the repairs without it. Granted, it will eventually be ordered as part of probation, but the way the law works is we don't have debtor's prison. And in order to be violated for failing to pay restitution, you actually have to have the means to pay it. Inevitably, after the tears subside and the realization sits in, I ask the victims, wouldn't this have been easier? Couldn't this have been all been avoided if the contractor had some sort of escrow requirement? And you knew what was happening to your money before you gave them more money or you listened to another excuse. The answer is always yes. And then I ask them, would you tell the legislature that? And then they always tell me, I would happily do so, so other people don't end up like me. I don't have the answers. My job isn't to write the law. It's to enforce it. I always tell jurors in jury selection, if you don't like the law, your problem isn't with me. It's with you people here in Tallahassee. But I'm here talking to you for those people that sit in my office and cry at that table and call me every week. In no other area do we give such large payments with such little oversight. I urge you, when looking at any proposed law changes in this area, to consider two premises. One, if we walked out on the street and talked to someone walking by and said, if you gave someone money to do a job and they didn't do it, would that be theft? And I think most people would say yes, but the law doesn't exactly work that way. Two, my money should go to my job. It shouldn't go to my neighbor's house. It shouldn't go to the materials from the job last month. The biggest problem we have in Florida is that too many contractors in our state rob Peter to pay Paul, creating essentially a Ponzi scheme to keep their businesses going. When they run out of customers, the bottom falls out. At least if it's a bank loan or a construction loan, the state attorney's office, law enforcement has the ability to trace those draws. And it may take years to do, but with cash, sometimes it's almost impossible. The changes enacted a few years ago to Florida Statute 489.126 turned it into a workable statute. And I urge you to make the same sort of changes to Statute 713.345. I would also point out that some of the proposed changes to the statute would protect the material suppliers as well. In doing these cases, you learn a few things, and one of the things that I've learned is very few subcontractors actually file liens because they have to keep working for the general contractor. They typically only do it if there's a financial problem. So when the bottom drops out, a lot of the times the subcontractors are also left with no payment for their work. As you consider any changes to this statute, I want you to remember that the first proposal of this statute leaves open the ultimate level of scienter. Whether it should be knowing and intentional to match the rest of the statute is up to you. However, as a canon of statutory construction, I'd urge you to remember that in a licensing scheme with a statement of statutory intent, you don't have to have a strict liability crime, just like contracting without a license during a state of emergency. As Florida continues to grow, I urge you to continue to protect the state's largest investment, which is the people and their finances that they come here with. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Again, we're going to hold questions till all three presenters are finished. Next up, we have John Durrett, State Attorney, the Third Judicial Circle. Welcome, sir. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you all for having us here in Tallahassee. It's actually my first time I've ever been to the Capitol. It's quite impressive. And as to the committee, Hurricane Resiliency and Recovery, I'm from the Third Circuit of Florida. The state attorney there, we cover seven counties. Mr. Shove handles some of those. And I'd like to think of us, we are a very resilient group of people in the Third Circuit. And we've turned to each other a great deal, you know, in cleaning up debris and, you know, people getting together and bringing their chainsaws out, helping one another, getting things picked up and taken care of. I know Jason reached out to me several times, and Ms. Moody as well, to talk about any assistance they could give. And I told him, you know, I think we'll be all right. We can handle this, and we're getting through it. But we're not here just to hear me talk about the great people of the Third Circuit, because they are the best in the state of Florida. But anyway, we'll move on to the misapplication of construction funds. It's not something, candidly, that I've had to deal a whole heck of a lot with, fortunately. It has occurred with us, and there have been several instances where we have prosecuted it, and we have been successful in recovering. It's not as widespread for us as it is in the larger urban centers, I recognize. I stand in support of my comrades as they seek to amend to establish an escrow requirement. It makes perfect sense to me, and I support them in that endeavor. Now, what we have, and what I've, you know, maybe I'll go off topic a little bit, the unlicensed contractors, and I'm telling you, right now, I mean, how many you got, John? I don't know, because they're coming in by the, I mean, I probably got 25 reports last week, people making complaints. You know, the hurricane hit us right there in August. And so, you know, the people are, you're scrambling, they're trying to get the work done and what have you. These people are flooding in from everywhere. And I mean, as far away as Utah, California, coming in and trying to prey upon people at their most vulnerable time. And then, of course, you know, they'll string them along for a bit, do part of it, you know, misrepresenting things they actually can do and cannot do, and they're leaving these persons just in a terrible situation. I know in the state of emergency it gets reclassed to an F3, a third-degree felony variety. I would be a proponent of it being a third-degree felony variety in any circumstance, for the damage is often so significant. I mean, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, which, I mean, that's devastating to most people, to, you know, that they're putting their faith in these persons that just take advantage of them. And when we're dealing with it as a misdemeanor offense, and these people, these fly-by-night jokers, that then they disappear, and I can't extradite them back to the great state of Florida on a first-degree misdemeanor, and we don't have enough time to get some restitution back or a penalty to hold over them. That's, you know, in the state of emergency, it does allow for it, but I would ask that that be expanded to all circumstances outside of the state of emergency, and you can even go higher when that comes to be. But with that, ladies and gentlemen, just thank y'all for having me here. I appreciate it, and any questions that I can, I will do my level best to answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your insights. Next up, we have Larry Bassford, State Attorney, 14th Judicial Circuit. Welcome, sir. You're recognized.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Grant and distinguished members of this committee. I am Larry Bassford, and I'm from the 14th Judicial Circuit, and some of you may not know where that is, but that's our home city there is Panama City, and it encompasses Bay, Gulf, Calhoun, Jackson, Holmes, and Washington counties. On October the 10th of 2018, shortly after lunchtime, Hurricane Michael made landfall. It was a Category 5 hurricane with winds of 160 miles an hour. We had a storm surge between 9 and 14 feet between Mexico Beach and Port St. Joe over there in Gulf County. 60,000 homes were damaged by this hurricane. 1,300 over in Bay County were either completely destroyed or heavily damaged, and then another 2,000 in Gulf County, where Representative Shelf represents. Estimated damage from this hurricane was over $18 million to our property and our infrastructure. The average cost of repairing a home, if it could be repaired, they said was $80,000, but I would submit that it was much more than that for the average home. We knew early on, because of our experiences like in South Florida, that we were going to be inundated with unscrupulous contractors, so we formed a hurricane task force. And I think we were pretty effective in deterring some of those people from out of state and out of county early on from getting out of there, because we tried to educate our public. But even with that, even with all of our efforts with state and local law enforcement, to date, since October the 10th of 2018, we have prosecuted or are in the process of prosecuting 718 cases of construction fraud. Now, that includes contracting without a license. It includes scheme to defraud. It includes grand theft. And it's a continuing problem. I'd like to give you just three brief examples of some of the problems that we're having. One contractor took advantage of 15 different families for a total of $525,000. This was a licensed contractor, and we are prosecuting him for a scheme to defraud. We couldn't prosecute him for simply grand theft because under the statute, these families did not send out a letter that the legislature has provided that gives us the basis to prosecute for grand theft. Because if some of you may already know, in order to prove grand theft, we have to prove at the time of the taking that person, or in this situation, the contractor, had the intent to defraud the homeowner. In another case, three victims, three families were defrauded for a total of $227,000, and we're prosecuting that individual for grand theft over $20,000. We can prosecute him, but he is already in prison for doing similar activities, a scheme to defraud over in the First Circuit. So they got a first shot at him. He's doing 15 years, and we will prosecute him. But the chances of getting restitution for any of these victims is zero. And then finally, the last person that I would like to bring to your attention, 19 victims were defrauded out of $150,000. This was an unlicensed contractor, and she is being prosecuted for contracting without a license during a state of an emergency, as well as grand theft. 16 of those victims were there in Bay County. Three of those were over there in Gulf County. As my colleagues have indicated, we do take these cases very seriously because these stories that we hear are heartbreaking, especially when they come from elderly or disabled individuals. And half of these 38 victims in these three cases were senior citizens or 65 and older. And even though we put people in prison, that may deter a few people, but we are not getting restitution for those victims, and their homes are still unfinished, and they still have liens, and it's just a heartbreaking story. So what can you do to help us, okay? We believe this proposed legislation of requiring contractors with cash money, and this we're talking about using cash money, to require them to put that money in an escrow is a good first step to prohibiting and stopping the misappropriation of construction funds if they know they're going to have to give an accounting for it. Yes, could these citizens have used more care when they selected a contractor? Because most contractors, as we know, are honest, hardworking people. They could have. But if your area has been devastated by a hurricane, like many of you, Representative Shoaf, and I'm not unfamiliar with some of you down here, but I believe Representative Franklin, aren't you from Tallahassee? Okay, yes, Gadsden County. So you suffered some injuries too. I'm sure some of your constituents have. You know all too well that after a hurricane, our citizens are in a state of shock, and all they want is to get their electricity turned back on and be able to get their home repaired so they can live there. And we've had several intelligent people taken advantage of because they were in that state of shock, and they were not as careful as they should have been when they were selecting a contractor. So anything that we can do to protect our citizens, I would urge you to take that step. And again, I welcome any questions, and I'll be glad to try to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you for your attention to this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Bassford. Appreciate your testimony. We'll let you sit there and answer any questions rather than coming to the podium, just to make it more efficient. Mr. Durrett, thank you for being here for the first time. We have a certain ceremony that we're going to put you through after this meeting, so just want to let you know that. In the meantime, questions, members? Representative Cassell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for being here. As a former assistant state attorney, I appreciate your dedication to your communities and the individuals and people that you serve. I know it's a job, sometimes that's a pretty thankless job, but when you go home at night, you get to rest your head on your pillow knowing you're doing a great thing. I'm just curious, I know property loss damage claims are eligible for victim compensation fund. Do you find that there's sufficient funds to, pay these individuals back? Is that something else we should consider?
You're recognized.
That is definitely something that you should consider. It is not enough. And one of the things that we've seen is we've had large-scale developers go under, and the Construction Industry Licensing Board, the Construction Recovery Fund, is capped at a certain amount. And so, and one of the other problems is it's a race to see who got a judgment first to be able to recover those funds. And so I think these are things that you need to consider. And one of the things that we talked about is if we had an escrow account, if you're an attorney, our interest on trust accounts, that money goes towards people who are ripped off by attorneys, and that could be something that could be done.
Follow-up? Representative Franklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks so much for coming by and explaining all these catastrophes that are happening. My heart goes out when I hear about folks getting taken advantage of in those difficult moments of vulnerability. My question's around, kind of piggybacking on what Rep. Cassell said, was around any insurance tools that exist. The reason I bring that up, because oftentimes I think about ensuring that our barrier to entry, as long as someone's working hard, doing all things they're supposed to do, barrier of entry into the construction business, right? So, it's always great for me to see folks pull themselves up and work hard and start companies. But when we start talking about putting capital in an escrow, that becomes a lot more difficult for a hardworking person to get there. Are there any tools in the insurance space, like in liability or something, that could be considered where maybe you have to have that insurance or that liability tool where if you did commit some sort of misfortune, there is some sort of, payout for these folks who are getting committed these crimes on?
You recognized?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Just earlier before, we met with some individuals from the construction industry, and that was one of the things that we had discussed. If something along the lines of a performance bond was posted or some type of letter of credit, that's what they suggested. And we've been talking with them about the proposed legislation here. Currently, I do not know of any insurance available for this.
Representative Escuani.
Thank you so much, Sharon. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. This has been super insightful, and I do thank you for your work, too. I feel like these are really common situations, unfortunately, and obviously in the context of hurricanes, it's more frequent and extreme. I'm curious for your perspective on just, on the day-to-day reality of this. What are some regulatory responsibilities and policy changes on the, not just the prevention side, but I'm also thinking there are some cases that they're still really upsetting, but maybe they're not to the large scale of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. So that consumer may not want to seek a criminal path for prosecution. Maybe they want to seek a regulatory path of accountability. My understanding is that those are not very strong or available. And this can also include things like wage theft, where someone signs a contract for work to be paid to them and they do the work and they don't get paid. And so could you speak more to, when you see a case, what determines that you take it to a criminal path versus do you have other options for folks maybe want more of like a consumer protection route? And then just in the prevention piece, what would you be your thoughts to preventing this from happening in the first place?
Anybody want to take that one?
Well, I think DBPR does govern the construction phase. And when DBPR sees that a violation has occurred that is criminal, they're required by statute to refer it to the state attorney. And that's something we may review and may determine if it's something that should go to law enforcement for further investigation, because when it's a felony, I have to have sworn statements from all the material witnesses. In the regulatory space, I can't exactly tell you because that's not really my purview. But the issue is if there are other means for the the primary thing is people want their money back. So as Mr. Bassford said, as I said, we can put somebody in prison for forever, but that doesn't give them their money back. And so what we hope to do with some of these changes is to, one, prevent people from victimizing people, but also give them a means to have some level of control of where their money is going.
Representative Chambliss, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you guys for coming up here and sharing with us. I had a situational question, trying to figure out who would be liable in this particular scenario. So I remember when we had Irma a couple of years ago. I was working for a commissioner in Miami-Dade County, and one of the issues was that we were trying to get people to come and pick up debris, and contractors were holding out, and it was a real weird thing. I don't know the details of why they weren't doing the work, but they were available to do the work and didn't. Here's my question. What ended up happening is, in some of the low-income communities, you had mountains of debris that had been there for so long because of the failure to do the work, that rodents and other hazards had been created. And so in a situation like that, where there's a failure to do the work for whatever reason, if there had been, say, a young person that had been injured or any other hazard hazardous situation to where someone had been injured because of a failure to do the work, is there any remedy, is there any legal remedy to hold someone liable for that situation?
Anybody want to take that one? You're recognized, sir. Thank you.
I don't believe there's any criminal remedy that is available. As far as civil, we are forbidden to practice anything but this. And although I was in private practice for a couple of years, I didn't do any personal injury work in that area, sir. But we did have numerous problems with illegal dumping, and they'd pick it up one place and then dump it right down the road. And we did prosecute those and forfeit their property to the law enforcement agencies in an attempt. And most of those people were from out of county and out of state.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, based on that experience, do you think that the current statutes adequately capture that scenario? And is there availability currently under the statute to prosecute that in a way in which it can be prosecuted, especially if we have so many out-of-town, maybe out-of-state contractors that might be the individuals that are, say, committing, whether it's illegal dumping or et cetera?
Well, I think there are two issues. The first issue you addressed, Representative, the question is if they were paid and they failed to do the work, that would be a different situation. We might be able to prosecute under that scenario. And then the second issue is if they're unlicensed and it's something that's covered by the contractor's statute, then we would we'd be able to prosecute them for a felony in those situations. So that's kind of how we would answer those questions.
All set? Well, thank you for being here. I'm sorry. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. A question. Do you know a percentage of how many of these cases are directly related to unlicensed contractors versus just bad licensed contractors?
My circuit, it's primarily the unlicensed. And with those misapplication cases where they're robbing Peter to pay Paul, we encounter that, but not frequently in my neck of the woods, thank goodness. But that's a whole other can of worms, the unlicensed. They're all over the place.
Mr. Miller?
We have, because the 20th Judicial Circuit, as many of you know, is Charlotte, Lee, Collier, Hendry, and Glades. And so primarily Charlotte and Collier are gigantic growth centers. And so we have had numerous problems with licensed contractors in both of those counties going out of business, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And, you know, we try to do what we can, but oftentimes, even when we prosecute that individual, we're left with no restitution for those folks who came here most often from another state.
Mr. Bassford?
A number of ours were for unlicensed contractors. These two out of the three examples I had were licensed contractors, but I would say anywhere from a third to a half or maybe even more were unlicensed contractors. Again, we're able to put some of those people on pretrial intervention with a condition that they pay restitution. Some of them have the option of doing that up front. Some of them still are in business maybe in other states. If they're a licensed contractor here, that's pretty easy, and they're able to continue to work. And we've been able to get restitution in those situations. So I would say anywhere from a third to at least a half were unlicensed contractors. And we were discussing earlier, our legitimate contractors are sort of like attorneys. When you have one bad attorney, it reflects on the entire occupation, and the legitimate contractors do not want the unscrupulous contractors operating in their area. At least that's been our experience.
Representative O'Tanner.
Thank you, Chair. This question is probably for Mr. Miller. My district is Bonita Springs, to Boca Grande and Bonita Springs. We have a lot of, homeowners associations, and we've had a lot of stuff. It's been about a year now since we have people coming to us saying where the insurance has paid the homeowner association, then they go out and get the contractor, and half the work is done. You know, and they keep, you know, there's the money's gone. Is there anything we can do from the state to kind of help these folks out?
You recognize.
Well, I think the first issue is if that's been referred to law enforcement for review would be the first issue, because if they've been paid and they've failed to act, but some of the problems we've seen is there may not be enough people to work, or some contractors have taken too many jobs. But eventually they're going to finish that. We do have situations, though, where we have had cases with homeowners associations where they've been taken advantage of. So the first thing is to refer it to law enforcement and let law enforcement take a look at it, and they'll talk to us, and we'll see if that's something we can potentially prosecute.
Follow up? Find me after the meeting.
Anybody else? Again, thank you. I know you've traveled a long distance to get here. This is an important topic and one that does not often get discussed. But contractor fraud, whether it's post-hurricane or just in the normal course of business, is a big deal in the state of Florida. And I appreciate your insights on some of the things that we can do to maybe stem that and keep our citizens safe in their homes and keep their money in their bank and in their wallets, rather than having it going out of state to unlicensed or unscrupulous contractors. So thank you. Any final comments? I would welcome you. Yes, of course. It's part of the ceremony. Members, next we have a panel comprised of a cross-section of the ag industry to share their perspectives on how the hurricane has impacted their industry. We will have time for all the panelists to finish their remarks, and then we'll ask questions. So first up, we have Jim Spratt of the Florida Ag Coalition. We have Tim Solano, owner of T. Solano Sea Farms. We have Ben White, president of the Jefferson County Cattlemen's Association. Phil Watts, assistant operations manager of the Full Circle Dairy. He is also representing the United Dairy Farmers of Florida. And finally, we have Richard Swab with M.A. Rigoni, if I pronounce that correctly, Incorporated. Mr. Spratt, welcome. Nice to see you again. We'll begin with you and work our way down the table. You're recognized, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Again, Jim Spratt. I have had the opportunity to work with many of you. I sit here today as the chair of the Florida Ag Coalition. Let me start by saying thank you for this committee's work and for taking the time to have this discussion today. As you all know, over the past couple of years, the Florida ag industry has suffered some major destruction from natural disasters. Most recently, with Hurricane Idalia, more than 3.3 million acres of Florida ag land were impacted. None of the commodities in the area were left unscathed, whether you were a dairy or aquaculture, nursery, timber, beef cow, row crop, you all got hit on the chin. This is not a new story. We've seen it happen with Ian. We saw it happen with Michael. We saw it happen with Irma. We can keep going down the lines. In a preliminary report, and I would say this is conservative, estimated $370, $380 million in economic loss and crop loss from Hurricane Idalia, with a breakdown of that kind of ranging from animal to animal products, which would include poultry, dairy, beef cow, aquaculture, north of $123 million, field and row crops north of $93 million, forestry products, $64-plus million in estimated losses, and greenhouse and nursery products north of $68 million. As I'm sure you will hear today, for many of these crops, these are multi-year crops, and so this is a conservative snapshot, number one. I think number two, when you start dealing with animals and the stress that they go through in a storm, I think we'll hear more about that. It's really hard to get an accurate number of exactly what the impact is, so I would reiterate those are conservative numbers. In addition to the crop loss, many of these producers lost key infrastructure, barns, equipment sheds, center pivot irrigation, fences, greenhouse structures, the cages, the nets used in aquaculture damaged by the storm. Now, what we have learned is that the typical role has been for the federal government to come in vis-a-vis crop insurance if it was available to you, or vis-a-vis a supplemental for disaster. What we have learned is while we appreciate what our federal government can do on occasion, the dysfunction is such that it's getting a longer and longer and longer time lapse between day of impact to actual any chance of being made any portion of whole. And what I mean by that is I'll go back to Hurricane Michael and certainly other earlier storms you can find similar things. With Hurricane Michael, nearly 18 months from landfall before the first payment was made to timber farmers and landowners. Quite frankly, with Idalia, because of the dysfunction in Washington, any talk of a supplemental disaster package or update in the Farm Bill has been kicked down the road. So indeterminate on when we may see any federal relief on this. Thankfully, what we did see in early November, thankfully, what we did see is after Idalia impacted, Commissioner Simpson and his team were on the ground probably first. I know many on this committee and many in the Senate reached out to myself, reached out to others in the industry, Representative Shove, Representative Tant, Representative Gallup, all from the area up here, as well as Senators Simon and Albritton and Senator Collins, all reached out and said, what can we do? To take that a step forward, this legislature, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Speaker Renner, President Pasadomo, Representative Shove, Senator Collins, the whole crew. We had a special session, and we passed, for the first time ever, probably one of the most meaningful pieces of disaster relief legislation for the ag industry we've ever seen. And so I would be remiss if I did not say thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm happy to report that I believe the Department of Ag is well on their way to having the rules and the things in place so that our producers that were impacted by Idalia can see some relief sooner rather than later. My hope is that we can use this discussion as a continuation of what we did at special session, and that we can continue the discussion into long and meaningful things we can do both for resiliency and to protect our farmers. And with that, I would turn it over to the rest of the members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Ms. Solano, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Grant, Vice Chair Botana, and the Ranking Member Chambliss for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Timothy Solano. I'm a second-generation clam farmer and wholesaler, and I'm also a proud 14th-generation Floridian with roots dating back to 1607. I'm a member of the Cedar Key Aquaculture Association and the appointed Florida representative for shellfish on our Aquaculture Review Council. I, along with my two siblings, run one of the largest wholesales in Cedar Key, selling our product to Costco wholesales all over the East Coast as far as Maine with major Costco depots in New Jersey. Hurricane Idalia was an absolute devastation, not only to our family shop, but to every farmer and wholesaler in the Big Bend region. The Commissioner of Ag, Wilton Simpson, came out in late September with the Hurricane Idalia impact report, putting aquaculture at $34.1 million in damage. But that number is still gradually rising to this day. With the outrageous riptide that we experienced, it caused debris such as crab traps, docks, trees, and other building material to be dragged across the middle of our clam leases, causing our bags to be ripped up out of the clam beds and swept out to sea. These strong currents also brought sand and mud that covered our bags that were ready for harvest, which caused our clams to start suffocating and dying, causing a process called fouling to occur, which produces more death. The current also caused a lot of our younger bags and our next farm cycles to be compromised, blown up out of their clam beds and twisted up with the other bags surrounding, not allowing these clams to naturally settle back into their state, causing them to stress and die as well. When this happens, you have a lot of things such as predators, as crabs, black drum, stingray, and conchs that are introduced to the picture also. Our industry in Florida was on track to do close to $45 million in sales in 2023. And now a lot of us are just fighting to keep the sales that we have left. With strong competition coming from Virginia and even some clam competition coming out of Southeast Asia, we're at risk of losing our Florida market share. Florida is the second largest in the nation for clam production, with 90% of that coming out of our coastal water working front called Cedar Key. With that being said, we need to be able to hold that spot and again one a day, once again become number one in the nation. It takes us 18 to 21 months to produce a clam for marketable size. Our industry right now is looking at roughly 2 years before we can get back to where we were before this storm and even think about trying to expand markets. The clam farmers of Florida are hurting. Shops are closing their doors, people are getting laid off, and wholesalers are having to turn away holiday sales, which has lost revenue not only for them, but also for the great state of Florida. For example, my family shop from last year, from the month of November to December, we made equivalent to what we're gonna make in the whole year of 2023 due to the loss from Hurricane Idalia. That's why I'm here as a member of the association that represents clam farmers in Levy, Dixie, and Citrus County asking for help. While we know that Florida generally does not make direct payments to growers or farmers for production replacement, we are uniquely cash-strapped because of the timing of these hurricanes and the large loss of product. We are thankful for the provisions in the hurricane relief package you all passed out a few weeks ago, which did include the agricultural bridge loan, but frankly, in clam farmer, we're loaned out. It is difficult for a clam farmer to justify applying for a loan right now to buy more seed, because what happens if there's another hurricane next year? Instead, if possible, we would love for the legislator to consider spending or appropriating approximately $3 million to help us expedite us getting back to farming. The breaking down of this money would be $5,000 to each active leaseholder in the affected counties, and would help give us breathing room and allow us to stay in line with Florida's best management practices. This relatively small amount of money per farmer would allow them to purchase 250,000 clam seed and enough bags to plant them all in. In return, that would be 125 million clams going back into the Big Bend region to be planted for the harvest for the next year. Wholesalers could use this money also to make repairs on their shops that are needed, such as docks that were destroyed, walk-in coolers and ACs that are actually required by the state of Florida to have, but also are detrimental to us continuing to hold a fresh farm product in Florida. So having some of this money will help us with the costs we've already had to come out and fix. Looking towards the future of the industry as a whole, we would like to explore setting up an aquaculture disaster relief fund that can be deployed quickly after natural disasters. The clam farmer usually finds that the best time to plant his clams in final grow-out stage is in the fall, which happens to be during hurricane and following hurricane season. That way your clams only have to go through one summer cycle, so you're not having to lose as many due to the heat that we've been having recently. As I previously mentioned, timing is a key issue for us, and we often do not have Time to wait for loan programs to open or for state money to be appropriated that would be released. In the best case scenario, several months after the storm. As hurricane strength and frequency increases, we're hopeful that such a program can help us continue to be proactive rather than reactive in Florida. I thank you for your time, and God bless you all, and God bless the state of Florida.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Next up, we have Ben White, president of the Jefferson County Cattlemen's Association. Welcome. You're recognized.
Thank you, Terry Grant. I appreciate y'all giving me the opportunity to speak to y'all today. My name is Ben White. I am owner and operator of WW Cattle in Jefferson County and also the president of Jefferson County Cattlemen's Association. I just wanted to kind of speak to y'all today about the impacts that hurricanes have on the beef industry in our part of the Florida, and answer any questions y'all might have afterwards. I'd also like to start off by saying thank you for everyone for ag for the last few years, including getting the sales tax removed from our necessities. We need our fence materials and our other things that we need for Florida to keep building fences and keep our cows contained and keep our stuff going in. They've also, one of the differences in the beef cattle industry versus the other industries when a hurricane hits, we don't know what our long-term damages are. The stress that the cows went through, the weight loss on the calves that we're, you know, making for the following year, the amount of contamination we get in the water, their food source, everything's messed up, and we don't know everything from day one. So our long term, we don't know what it is for a while. We can assess all the physical damage caused by the storms within the first few days. There are long-lasting effects on animals as well. It may be months before we know what effects the storm had on our cattle food sources, our water source, and most importantly, their health. From a cattle farmer's point of view, when a hurricane hits, the first thing we want to do is make sure our family is safe, make sure our house is back up and running, make sure we're good to go, and the next step is checking on our neighbors, making sure they're good, and then we go to check on the cows. The cows are like children to us. Our county was not hit near as hard as our neighboring counties, Madison and Taylor County, but they still, on our little farm, we still had 2 days worth of tree cleanup and fence repairs just to keep our cows in. I was honored to be able to assist the Florida Cattlemen's Foundation Disaster Research or Relief Team clean up in Madison and Taylor County. They brought in cattlemen from all over the state, and they were able to help the hardest hit counties of Madison and Taylor and get cows back in, get fences repaired, trees off of fences, haul generators to their houses, and make sure their families were up and moving. One of the biggest things we have to worry about up here is getting water to our cattle. Most of our cows up here are watered by wells, and when the power goes out, so does the water for the cattle. We found that this year we hauled water in nurse tanks. Most of those tanks are 1,000-gallon nurse tanks, which will hold a herd of 50 cows for only one day. The cows drinking 20 gallons of water a day each, it's not feasible for us to haul water to the cows to keep them watered. The most important way we found to do it, or the easiest way we found to do it, was putting generators on the wells and just running generators to keep the wells going so that the water never stopped. Our cows would be with, you know, they'd still have feed, they'd still have water and everything. They could go back, we could go back on to fixing everything else that needed to be fixed around the county. We would like to see if there was some way that we could get a stockpile of generators just for the cattle wells that we could distribute, you know, and we'd be willing to help distribute those as needed, whatever we needed to do for that. Thanks to today's social media, everyone can see the physical damages that a hurricane causes residential neighborhoods and our beautiful beaches in Florida. Unfortunately, the area in Florida between the beaches is where the cattle lives, and it is affected by and handles hurricane damages and recovery in a whole different manner. One big problem we're running into is the majority of our fence line that keeps our cattle contained and safe are in tree lines. When a hurricane comes, it wipes the trees out, hence wiping our fences out. At this time, the safety of our cattle is a major concern, and they are very good at escaping out of any hole that is made. They will end up on the highway, which puts our citizens at risk for being in wrecks, and it also puts our cattle in danger of getting run over. The other major problem we have is our working pens that we work our cattle in. Once the fences are done, we work our cows to keep them going. We usually build those pens up underneath the oak trees to keep the cows safe and shaded out while we're working them. The damage in Madison and Taylor County that I saw on the fence lines and the working pens was unbelievable. Those pens that their great granddaddies had built, were all destroyed in a matter of minutes. The portable cow pens are one way to get around not having a pen until you can get a pen rebuilt. They're also very usable, very helpful in using to recover cattle that are off the property, and also being able to load them up and haul them off to another piece of property to keep them safe. During the hurricane special session you just held, you passed a lot of sales exemptions to help us recover, and we really, really appreciate that. Also, a couple years ago, you passed a sales tax exemption on fence, which was a great big help. But when it went to the Department of Revenue, they defined it as only relating to barbed wire and hog wire, not wooden or electric fence posts, not panels, not other things we use to hold in cattle, just the wire. So last year, you cleaned it up and exempted items that contained cattle, and we thought that brought an end to this debate. I say all this because this past Friday, the Florida Cattlemen's Association received a taxpayer assistance advisement that exempted just about everything we asked for, except for the portable cow pens that we need. We would ask that you would consider putting those portable cow pens on our tax exemption list also. Once again, I would like to thank you all for the chance to speak with this panel. I would love to answer any questions that I can.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Phil Watts, Assistant Operations Manager of Full Circle Dairy, and he's also representing the United Dairy Farmers of Florida. You're recognized, sir. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me here. It is an honor to be able to come and speak in front of you all today. I have a PowerPoint here that I'm going to go through and kind of show some damages that happen across the state of Florida and at our farm individually as well. This is just a breakdown of what United Dairy Farmers of Florida is and kind of how we're made up, with our presidents and vice presidents, and then members across the state that are dairy farmers. This is individually to our farm. We're on 2,100 acres in Madison County. We milk 3,500 head of Holstein cows. Typically during the day, we produce about 40,000 gallons of milk each day. Our mission statement on the farm is Full Circle strives for excellence in dairying by providing the best cow comfort and highest quality feed as possible, emphasizing the importance of detail. We produce a wholesome natural product using sustainable and responsible practices. Our success relies on our employees and our teamwork. We are a family working together to provide the best environment and tools for our employees to be successful. Something we really pride ourselves on. I mean, we're a family-owned farm that went through this hurricane, had significant damage from it. Hurricane Idalia's impact across our community in the North Florida was 22 dairies. That almost makes up 50% of the dairies across the whole state of Florida now. That event is going to tail itself out to a loss in milk production currently during the storm, and then throughout the rest of the year and in the beginning of the year, due to the lag and the stress that those animals had on them. Here are some happened on dairies across the state. This was a dairy south of us that's in Lafayette County, and over to our east in Suwanee County. They actually lost their feed shed there. So their feed that they had stored to feed all their cows was now ruined, and they were not able to feed most of that feed, and most of it did get thrown out. This would be a dairy south of us in Lafayette. Had significant damage to employee housing, trailers to transport cows. Unfortunately for this dairy, they're mostly a grazing dairy, or cows are out on pasture, So whenever they had fences that went down, like what Mr. Ben said here, you know, those same trees fell on fences over in our county, and those cows are out. And unfortunately for them, they didn't have a trailer in order to go and start pending up cows and herding them back up. So back to Full Circle Dairy, this is a little bit of damage that we saw at our farm. We lost our fuel depot there, as well as our working shop that we had storage in for some seed that we would plant this time of year, our ryegrass seed. And then, as well, we had damage to our irrigation systems. So on our 2,100 acres, we actually had 800 of those acres that had irrigation systems that were damaged. And so that gave us a loss of crop production for this upcoming year throughout the rest of the year that we will not have that feed and storage for the year to feed the cows. Just kind of summarizing a little bit of, you know, everything at Full Circle Dairy, we had, you know, buildings that were damaged. Our commodity shed took some damage as well, where we store our feed for the cows. As far as equipment, we have over 1,000 fans on our farm in the barns in order to keep cows cool. Approximately 300 fans were damaged during that storm. Even though we were out of power on half of the farm, we still brought in generators in order to hook them up to those barns and make sure we had fans to keep the cows cool. That is one important thing with us, is keeping cows comfortable, and that's keeping them cool with fans and making sure they have good bedding where they're able to stay comfortable in their barns. In order to get replace those 300 fans, we actually, the day after the storm, ordered 250 fans, which is about $90,000 worth of fans to come in and replace. And that was before we could ever even get anything from insurance, anything like that. But we had to do it in order to the best sake of the cows. And then, of course, the crop production, there's a loss there, as well as the trail we're going to see of milk production throughout the rest of this year and this upcoming year. So as far as getting help, we did not see much help being able to come in for generators onto the farm. It was a lot of individual relationships that people had to rely on in order to get generators into their farms. And we're talking fairly big generators. These are going to be anywhere from 100 kW to 500 kW generators. These are not little generators that you can just go out and pick up anywhere. These are specialized generators to run fans, milking centers, things like that. The State Bridge Loan Program was a big help, though, to several of our producers throughout the state. So ideas for moving forward is being able to have access to generators that maybe dairies could rent, but being able to have them in a timely manner to the farms. It is very proprietary that, you know, power gets back to the dairy. That way we're able to get back up milking cows and keeping cows cool and comfortable. This is another slide on that, just some examples of maybe suggestions that could be made of renting generators and, you know, even having generators on the farm. It's a constant challenge of making sure to keep those generators up and keep the maintenance up on them, because, no, it's not every year that we're hit with a hurricane, but it's one of those things, whenever you need it, and you need it to work. Even after we got generators to the farm, one thing that we struggled with was getting electricians out to the farm in order to hook up these generators. Most of us are farmers. We know how to milk cows. We know how to feed cows. None of us pride ourselves on being electricians. And so we could get generators there, but it was very difficult to get them hooked up and get everybody back rolling. Another approach that we had is our dairy currently is working on putting in a methane digester to produce renewable natural gas. One of the struggles we found throughout the hurricane and after the hurricane was getting fuel out to the farm. And that was a struggle in getting diesel out there to fill these generators. Whenever we had you know, five of these large generators weren't running, there's a lot of fuel that we went through. If there is a bridge that we could have renewable natural gas as a fuel source on the farm to run these generators, would be a great bridge in order to keep everything rolling through the farm and having that extra energy source that we could other than diesel fuel. We are very grateful for our utility companies across North Florida. They strived hard in order to get power back on, and we're fortunate with our co-op that they did put us as a priority and got out to us and got as much power back going to our farm as they could. But even with us being out there, it's not a direct line to the where power is coming from. You know, there are a lot of fingers of lines that were down, so it takes time. But if we could emphasize getting power to those farms directly, then that would be a great help in taking pressure off of having to get those generators. So here's some more information just on the RNG and what we're going to produce on our farm. At the bottom, I have a link that kind of covers a little bit of video of our RNG production and gives a little bit more information about our farm. I'm Philip Watts with Full Circle Dairy in Madison County, Florida. I'm a fifth-generation dairy farmer. Here at Full Circle Dairy, we currently milk 3,500 head of Holstein cows three times a day that are producing about 40,000 gallons of milk each day that are brought to consumers throughout the state of Florida and the Southeast. We pride ourselves on being good stewards of the land and using our natural resources. Using our manure that we produce and being able to capture the methane off of it and convert it into renewable natural gas is another way that we find ourselves being good stewards of our natural resources. The natural gas that will be produced at Full Circle Dairy will then intersect and tap into a pipeline where consumers all across the state of Florida who are purchasing natural gas will be able to have access to the gas and the renewable gas that was produced at Full Circle Dairy. We find this as a very desirable product that we are also producing along with milk here because of what it can provide for the consumer as a natural product that can be used for cooking, it can be used for heating, it can be used as fuel. That's pretty awesome to us that cycle and everything full circle is coming together. Just like many consumers across the state of Florida, we rely on natural gas in order to heat and sanitize our products. We choose natural gas as our source of energy for these products because of its reliability and that we know that it's going to work whenever we need it to. Diversification of our property, of our land, of our business is key in moving forward for the future generation. And I hope one day that if my son is wanting to, he can be a sixth generation dairy farmer, and having that diversification of our business will help get us to where we need to be. Okay, so that was just a little video that we did with the Gas Association and kind of was a great overview of our farm and what we do. Here are just some ideas of summaries for kind of what we went over in this PowerPoint and what we can look and strive to do in preparation for the next hurricane. And if anybody has any questions, I'll be available. So thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Watts. Very informative presentation. Next up, we have Richard Schwab with M.A. Rigoni, Inc. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You did a great job. I've had some people come into the shop and say, is Rigoni there? But thank you very much. I am a third-generation business owner. Our company was founded in 1960 by Matt Ragone, and we've been logging on the same land base in the same area since 1960. My dad and his business partner bought that company, our company, in 1995, and my brother and I purchased it from them as they got ready to retire in the last couple of years. Most of us know here the impacts of Adelia and Michael and other things and really what it's done. I think the group as a whole has really spoke very well to that. Today, I want to talk a little bit about resiliency. I represent a logging company. We buy and harvest timber, and we've been cutting on the same tracts of land for I've cut personally in my career three times on some of the same tracts of timber, either thinning it or completely harvesting and having it replanted. The forest industry and forest land base that was impacted by Hurricane Adelia was tremendously impacted by, we lost rotations of timber. Typically, it takes 15 to 20 years for that rotation to come back. We've seen a lot of trees snapped off and blown over, but what we haven't seen yet, and is coming, are the trees that have been stressed. Root damage, other things that are going to show up and rear its ugly head. You're going to see trees by the thousands turning different colors at the wrong time of the year, whether they're hardwood or pine trees, and they're going to die. And so what I want to speak to is resiliency. You know, we can prepare for the next hurricane. We can spend a lot of money on recovery, which we are grateful for. We're grateful for the special session that happened, that we're going to have 75% of reforestation up to a certain point in some areas. Grateful for that. You guys did a great job on passing that legislation just a few weeks ago. And what I'm very impressed with is how fast it's being rolled out. And within a couple of weeks, we're going to see landowners with checks in their hands. We did a good job. That's good governance. That's good leadership that the state of Florida is notoriously known for. And that's what I love about this state, whether you're Democrat or Republican. We get things done in this state, and we do a great job doing it. But the point that I want to say is resiliency. Is I think that we as a governing body, as the House of Representatives or the Senate, not just from the executive branch, we need to be looking at resiliency in our industry. We need to be encouraging good governance from people that are stakeholders in the industry, whether they have a good climate to keep their businesses open, whether they're a consuming mill or they're a harvesting company like mine, or maybe just a timber growing company like a lot of private landowners are across this state. If we're going to keep forested land in working forests, which is great for the environment, it's great for water quality, it's a recharge area for our aquifer that keeps, and everybody benefits from that, not just the landowner, but every citizen of the state of Florida benefits from clean drinking water and clean air that trees produce. But if we're going to do that, we have to have a resilient industry that wants to consume that wood. Now, we've seen not just impacts in my hometown from Adelia, the hurricane, but we also saw a paper company fold up. We saw 250-500 jobs leave our community. But I want to say you need to multiply that by seven. There's seven times the impact of jobs for landowners, business owners, the auto parts store. That all affects everything else. But also on top of that right there, we also seeing poor governance in some of our municipalities that actually own power plants in our area that could consume the wood that's on the ground. Some power plants that can consume up to 1 million tons of wood a year have closed their doors because of poor governance for city councils, or maybe bad policy coming out from this body right here. I don't know. But those companies could be using the wood that's been on the ground. There was some estimates that there was 1 million tons of wood on the ground that FEMA picked up that we spent as tax dollars for somebody to go pick up and grind up and put on the ground instead of using it for a renewable energy resource. There's things, again, resiliency that we can do, and it's good governance coming from this body, good policy that makes it where businesses want to stay here, that they want to grow here, they want to continue to have employees here, because I would submit to you that in my small county of Taylor County, our biggest export that we've ever had come out of our county is not the paper that's been produced or the trees that have been cut in our county. It's our brain trust. And we, how many people have we lost in this state? Good quality people, because there's no opportunity for them to be the best that they can possibly be. Think about how great our state could be if we had resiliency in our industry and where we are, because we need to keep our working force working, and we need to keep our people working as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I can tell you're very passionate about that issue, and rightfully so, and I appreciate that very much. Members, we have questions. Questions? Representative Esposito.
Thank you, Chair. To our dairy farmer friends, can you talk a little bit about the RNG sales tax credit that we passed last year and how that's been beneficial to you?
You're recognized.
I am going to pass that one down to Jim.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, thank you for that question. You know, things flow a certain direction here, and I guess we figured out which way the table tilts. No, that has been very helpful, and I think it's step one into the process. I think there's more to be done in the RNG space, where it really gets to the meat and potatoes of helping the farmer, making it where it makes sense for the farmer to create those agreements. So I would say good first step. It is helpful. It is appreciative. I think there's more meat on the bone.
Representative Schoaf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the dairy farmers, after a storm when you lose power, you mentioned different facilities that you have that are critical for keeping your cows alive. You're on a clock. How many days, weeks, hours can you last, or can those cows last if you don't get power back up?
You're recognized.
You only have hours. Those animals, they're routine animals. So whenever you go down during a storm like that and you aren't able to milk, you're going off of your schedule, you only have a couple hours. And then those animals are going to start experiencing stress upon them. In those cases, you just need to get back up and get going. For instance, us on the farm, the storm hit about 9 o'clock in the morning. We stopped milking cows at that point. We started milking cows up about 12:30, 11 o'clock, and that was all of our team jumping in order to get everything repaired enough where we were able to milk those cows and start getting back on schedule.
Follow up? President Roach, do you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Escomani.
Thank you so much. Thanks, guys, for being here. I'm a bit of a city slicker from District 42 in Orlando, but I definitely appreciate everything y'all do in keeping our state moving forward, making sure there's food on the dinner plate. I was curious about your workforce and just their impact by the hurricanes. You know, obviously, we focus more on some of the, our cows or our lumber and just some of the actual harvesting you do, but workers are also impacted by hurricanes, whether their livelihood's impacted or maybe they're, you mentioned also the paper mill, and I'm sure that's having ripple effect in the community. So maybe just the intersections between your workforce and what you're doing, have you struggled to fulfill roles or has that been fluid? Maybe just speak a little more to those dynamics.
Anybody want to take that? Go ahead, sir. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not just due to hurricane. Most of us in the ag industry and small businesses have really been struggling with good qualified workforce all throughout the state. There's a lack maybe of expectation. You know, my children graduated high school in the early 2000s, and they were all encouraged very strongly to go to college, and that was the only option they basically were educated to. And we're finding that not everybody in Taylor County or in North Florida or across the state is really cut out for college. And I think that we're sometimes looked down upon a good trade workers, like what Mr. Watt said about electricians or welders or manufacturing, paper making, or even logging equipment operators. And so I think that a workforce development could be very instrumental in helping make a stronger Florida all the way around, whether you're recovering from a hurricane or you're or just living life. I think it's very important that we should encourage strongly trade schools and that type of secondary education for young men and women that are that we need very badly in our industries all the way around.
Anybody else want to comment? Yes, go ahead. You're recognized.
So with the clam farming industry, a lot of the wholesale shops are actually having to cut their days back at this time. Instead of harvesting a full 4 or 5 days of the week, they're only harvesting 2 days, which means some of the workforce is only going to, they're going to part-time now. And some small farmers, they're unable to even go out there to start pulling the dead bags off of their leases or continue their surveying because they're having to find other work to do because they don't have it in clams. And this is a very tough time of year to be out of work, as we all know, with a family and kids. But the in our industry, we are trying to like personally myself step back as the boss so that I can leave it more open to the guys being able to work more and letting it be more in their hands and me operating more from the office rather than me being hands-on, which kind of makes a work day go a little faster. And so they're getting more hours in actually right now. But also that's because we're having them do work such as rebuilding our docks right now that were destroyed from the storm. Just still helping out with cutting trees down, going out to the clam leases, removing bags that are 95 to 100% dead, bringing them in, dumping the product, pressure washing bags. So we're finding stuff for them to do because we know in our industry, if we let our workers go, it's going to be hard to get them back. And because clam farming is hard, same with any other farming. My dad told me as a kid, if farming was easy, everybody would do it. And this is the times where it shows you why everybody doesn't do it. So we're just trying to find everything we can right now.
Follow up.
Thank you so much. Quick follow-up on clamming, because I'm just not an expert. Can you walk me through what are your seasons, and do your workers migrate to other parts of the country, or are folks pretty stationary in Florida?
Whoever wants to take it.
Yep. So we all of our workers are local to the area. We're in Cedar Key, so everyone's within usually about 15 to 20 miles from Cedar Key who works there. For clam farming season-wise, summertime is just our slower when it comes to our nursery seed being produced. Just from the hotter water, there's different things being introduced to the clams young that they're just not as strong for, so they kind of die quicker. Compared to in the grow out phase, when they're about 3 to 4 months old, we can plant them really at any time of year. Now, using best planting, I guess you could say practices, you want to kind of look towards when the water's getting a little cooler, but it's not completely cold. So there's still a lot of food in the water, but there's not a lot of heat affecting the clams as well at the same time. So usually about this time of year, we are looking to plant a lot of our seed that will be going into grow out phases. We kind of plant our nursery right there around springtime. That's when there's a lot of food in the water, so the seed is kind of coming on a lot quicker. And then fall time being our big time to actually plant that seed into grow out phase in bigger bags to be harvested 12 to 15 months later.
Well, all set. Representative Tanton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really don't have very many. I have one question I'll get to you, but I first want to start by telling you all, thank you for coming. And you have taught me, along with all of us, about the richness of the agriculture industry in this part of the state. We don't get enough attention, I don't think, most of the time. I also want to applaud you for the expertise you've brought to the table today, as well as talking about the innovative work that you're doing in your fields. I've just learned a lot from listening to you. What I see in these communities, and I have the very precious gift of representing two counties represented here today, and what I have seen is just like what Mr. White said, in times of crisis, our employers looked out first for their families and then for their neighbors, including, and I saw firsthand employers reaching out to their employees to make sure they were safe and that they had a job to come back to, just like what Mr. Solano here just mentioned. During Hurricane Idalia, I was able to, I actually had an outreach by someone with 4-H in Wakulla who told me about a horse farm in distress in Madison, and it was the Cattlemen's Association who ferried water out to them for 39 horses that they were on the verge of losing. Hearing about cows that you're going to lose within a matter of hours is really eye-opening about the, you think about the school children in our state who are relying on the milk that comes largely from this area. I mean, this is something that I think that we really need, that I want to do more to support you all on, and I'm really glad that you're bringing all of these issues to our attention. I heard from a member this morning, a county commissioner in another county this morning, who said, we got to do something about our roads here because we got some roads and EMS vehicles can't get down it. And, you know, I usually take my tractor out, and I mow the road, and I clear the roads for them. But this is typical of our communities, our rural communities. It is neighbor helping neighbor to do sometimes basic governmental functions. And that's why these communities they've been asked to come here. They're not begging to come. They're being asked to come talk about this. And so this is something I've learned in the short while I've been able to represent these communities, and it's a gift. On the question on the issue that you raised from Ms. from Taylor and the resiliency of industry practices, can you come up with some recommendations for us as to what that would look like?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we touched on a little bit workforce development. A lot of times businesses might want to locate to some of these rural areas because that's where the forest is. And the workforce may not be quite there, whether it's pipe fitters, welders, engineers, those type of people. It's a gamut of all kind of things. I think that the state of Florida needs to realize how much benefit business actually generates as far as cash and trickle down, if you would, the other industries that feed into that business. And so I think it's very important that we have good governance up here as far as tax policy. I think infrastructure policy, how we invest, we need to be thinking. I see so much ground being turned into solar fields that are productive ag land, whether it's pasture or it's converting forest over to solar fields. When we have thousands upon thousands of renewable tons of material growing every day in the state of Florida, whether it's hay or it's timber, we can have a better portfolio of a renewable energy source, and where we promote good policy of using biomass, woody products, what grows here, because a lot of times when you harvest biomass and have good policy of a consuming meal for that material, you're taking the undesirable species out of the forest, and you're actually promoting good forest health. You're reducing the risk of wildfire on public land as well as private land. You're improving wildlife habitat by removing that understory, if you would, to make a healthy, resilient forest. That's the reason why so many thousands of acres are burning out west, because they're not harvesting timber. It's overgrown forest, and it's detrimental to the environment. It's what it's putting in the air, as well as poor water quality, as well as endangering people because of forest fires. That doesn't happen that much here in Florida, but it does from time to time. And so there's a whole gamut of what we can do as a legislative body to make business strong and resilient in our state. And it's good policy and good leadership coming out of and well thought out leader, you know, what if we do this, what does that do? If we do that, what does that do? And I know that we have some of the greatest minds in the country because we have the greatest state in the country.
I agree.
I have to agree with the attorney earlier, and we live in the greatest part of the state in the country. yes, North Florida's wonderful. But good policy. That's just good thought out, sound, good policy all the way around.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for bringing these experts together for us to learn from today. Appreciate that.
You're welcome. I would thank our staff and Representative Shoaf and yourself for bringing this to my attention and to our attention. It's important that we do this, so thank you. Thank you all. Gentlemen, thank you for your presentation today. Is there any final comments? Members, any comments? Any final comments? Well, this concludes our committee agenda, and seeing no further business before the Select Committee, Representative Roach moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.